At 4 a.m, before it was light, a hurricane bombardment of tremendous impact broke upon positions of the Russians' First Corps at Ustau. The German High Command, with Hindenburg ponderously calm, Ludendorff grim and tense, and Hoffmann behind them a mocking shadow, left their temporary headquarters at Löbau, 20 miles away, to take up a position on a hill from which Ludendorff intended to superintend on the spot the coordination of François and Scholz's corps. Before they could even reach the hill, news was brought that Ustau was taken. In the midst of rejoicing, the report was almost immediately followed by another denying the first. The roar of the artillery barrage continued. In the Russian trenches, the men of the famous First Corps, unfed like their fellows of the 23rd and drained of the will to fight, fled from under the torrent of shelves, leaving behind them as many dead as those who got away. By 11 a.m, the Russian First Corps had abandoned the field. The battle had been won by artillery alone, and Ludendorff, whose premature orders might have lost it, felt that the Russian Second Army was now broken through. But it was not beaten, and he found that, in contrast to other wars, the battle had not been won in a day. François's advance was still being held east of Ustau. The two Russian corps in the centre, a formidable body of men, were still attacking. The threat of Rennenkampf still hung over his rear. Roads were clogged with refugees and livestock. Whole villages were fleeing. German soldiers, too, were exhausted, and they, too, conjured pursuit out of the clatter of hoofs and cried, "They're coming!" which, as it passed down a column, became, "The Cossacks are coming!" On returning to Löbau, the High Command heard with horrified disbelief a report that François's corps was fleeing and that relics of its units were coming into Montovo. A frantic telephone call ascertained that retreating troops of the First Corps could indeed be seen in dispirited groups in front of the railroad station. If François's flank had somehow been turned, the battle might be lost. And for one awful moment, the prospect of a lost campaign, retreat behind the Vistula, abandonment of East Prussia, rose up as it had before Prittwitz. Then it was discovered that the troops in Montovo belonged to one battalion only, that in the fighting beyond Ustau had given way. Late that day, the truth that the Germans were not, after all, retreating to the Vistula, but advancing against Samsonov, finally penetrated Jilinski's headquarters. At last, he telegraphed to Rennenkampf that the Second Army was under heavy attack, and he should cooperate by moving your left flank as far forward as possible. But the objectives given were too westerly and not far enough advanced, and no mention was made of haste or forced marches. The battle was in its third day. Two armies, now totally committed, surged and gripped and broke apart and clashed again in confused and separate combats over a front of 40 miles. A regiment advanced, its neighbour was thrown back, gaps appeared, the enemy thrust through or unaccountably did not. Artillery roared, cavalry squadrons, infantry units, heavy horse-drawn field-gun batteries moved and floundered through villages and forests, between lakes, across fields and roads. Shells smashed into farmhouses and village streets. A battalion, advancing under cover of shell-fire, disappeared behind a curtain of smoke and mist to some unknown fate. Columns of prisoners, herded to the rear, blocked the advancing troops. Brigades took ground or yielded it, crossed each other's lines of communication, became tangled up with the wrong division. Field commanders lost track of their units, staff cars sped about, German scout planes flew overhead trying to gather information. Army commanders struggled to find out what was happening and issued orders which might not be received or carried out or conformed to realities by the time they reached the front. 300,000 men flailed at each other, marched and tiredly countermarched, fired their guns, got drunk if they were lucky enough to occupy a village, or sat on the ground in the forest with a few companions while night came. And the next day the struggle went on, and the great battle of the Eastern Front was fought out. General von François opened battle at dawn on the 28th with another great artillery barrage. Ludendorff ordered him to veer left to relieve the pressure upon Scholz's corps, which he believed to be greatly exhausted. Ignoring him, François held to a straight eastward advance, determined to complete envelopment of Samsonov's flank and cut off his retreat. After his successful disobedience of the day before, Ludendorff now almost pleaded with François to obey orders. The First Corps would render the greatest possible service to the army by carrying out these instructions, he said. Paying no attention, François drove eastward, posing detachments along the roads as he moved to keep the enemy from breaking out. In anxiety for the centre, Ludendorff and Hindenburg waited out the battle at Scholz's field headquarters in the village of Frögenau, about 2 miles from an even smaller village, Tannenberg. Orders were datelined from Frögenau. Ludendorff was again tortured by apprehension about Rennenkampf. Worried about Scholz's corps, angered at François, harassed by the very ineffective field telephone connecting him with that insubordinate commander, and by the absence of any telephone communication at all with Mackensen and Bello on his left wing, he was far from satisfied. Mackensen and Bello, confused by conflicting orders to take first this direction and then that, sent a staff officer by airplane to headquarters to straighten matters out. He received a far-from-friendly reception, because neither corps was in the location it was supposed to be. Toward afternoon, however, both were moving satisfactorily, Mackensen pushing after the broken Russian right wing, and Bello heading for the gap at Allenstein to attack the Russian centre. Now François's progress appeared more justified, and Ludendorff issued revised orders to him to pursue the direction he was already taking. Just as the conviction of coming victory began to settle warmly over German headquarters, news came in that Rennenkampf's army was unmistakably on the march. But the day's progress by now gave assurance that he would be too late. In fact, at that night's bivouac, Rennenkampf's nearest corps was still 20 miles from Bischofsburg, where Samsonov's 7th Corps had been defeated 2 days before. Making slow progress in hostile territory, Rennenkampf's furthest advance by the end of the next day, August 29, was some 10 miles farther west, but no farther south, and he had made no contact with Samsonov. None was ever to be made. The collapse of the famous 1st Corps, in whose resistance he had put such faith, on top of the collapse of the 6th Corps on his other wing, presaged the end to General Samsonov. Both his flanks were turned, his cavalry, the only arm in which he outnumbered the Germans, having been deployed too wide of the flanks, had played no useful part in the battle, and was now isolated. Supplies and communications were in complete chaos. Only the steadfast 15th and 13th Corps were still fighting. At his headquarters in Niedernburg, he could hear the sound of François's approaching guns. There seemed to him to be only one thing to do. He telegraphed Jilinski that he was leaving for the battlefront, and then, ordering baggage and wireless apparatus to be sent back to Russia, cut his communications with the rear. The reasons for his decision, it has been said, he took with him to his grave, but they're not hard to understand. The army that had been given him to command was crumbling under him. He became again a cavalry officer and divisional general, and did the thing he knew best. With 7 of his staff on horses commandeered from some Cossacks, he rode off to take personal command under fire in the saddle, where he felt at home. Outside Niedernburg on August 28, he took farewell of Major Knox. Samsonov was sitting on the ground surrounded by his staff, studying some maps. He stood up, took Knox aside, and told him the situation was critical. He said his own place and duty were with the army, but as Knox's duty was to report to his government, he advised him to return while there was time. He mounted, turned in the saddle, and said with a wistful smile, "The enemy has luck one day, we will have luck another," as he rode away. Later, General Martos, who was conducting the battle in his sector from a hilltop, had just ordered a column of German prisoners to be led out of the fighting line, when to his astonishment the general of the army came up on horseback with his staff. Samsonov asked about the retiring column, and on being told they were prisoners, he reined his horse close to Martos, leaned over to embrace him, and said sadly, "You alone will save us." But he knew better, and that night gave the order for a general retreat of what was left of the Second Army. The retreat during the next 2 days, August 29 and 30, was a mounting and inexorable disaster. The two centre corps, which had fought longest and best and had advanced the farthest and retreated last, had the least chance to escape, and were the most completely netted in the German envelopment. General Kluev's corps was still on the offensive when Bello broke through the gap on his right at Allenstein and completed the cordon around the Russian centre. His corps, and that of General Martos, thrashed about helplessly in the forests and marshes, in futile marches and wrong turnings, and vain attempts to regroup and make a stand, as the cordon was drawn tighter. In the swampy area where the roads were causeways, the Germans posted guards with machine guns at every crossing. The men of Martos's corps, in their last 4 days, were literally starving. Kluev's corps covered 42 miles in their last 40 hours without rations of any kind. Horses were unfed and unwatered. On August 29, General Martos and a few of his staff were attempting to find a way through the forest with an escort of 5 Cossacks. The enemy was firing all around. Major General Machakovsky, Martos's chief of staff, was killed by machine gun fire. Others in the group were picked off, one by one, until only one staff officer and 2 of his escort remained with the general. Having left his haversack with an aide who was now missing, Martos had had nothing to eat, drink, or smoke since morning. One exhausted horse lay down and died. The men dismounted and led the others. Darkness fell. They tried to guide themselves by the stars, but the skies clouded over. Troops were heard approaching and were thought to be friends because the horses pulled toward them. Suddenly, a German searchlight blazed through the woods and swung back and forth, searching for them. Martos tried to mount and gallop off, but his horse was hit. He fell and was seized by German soldiers. Later, in a dirty little hotel in Osterode, where Martos was taken as a prisoner, Ludendorff came into the room and, speaking perfect Russian, taunted him with defeat and boasted that the Russian frontier was now open to German invasion. Hindenburg followed, and seeing me disturbed, he held my hands for a long time, begging me to calm myself. In awkward Russian, with a heavy accent, he promised to return Martos's sword and took his leave with a bow, saying, "I wish you happier days." In the woods north of Niedernburg, the debris of Martos's corps was slaughtered or surrendered. Only one officer of the 15th Corps escaped to return to Russia. About 10 miles east of Niedernburg, the last of the 13th Corps, whose commander General Kluev had also been captured, entrenched themselves in a circle. With 4 guns, captured from a German battery in the woods, they held off the enemy all through the night of August 30, until they had no more ammunition left and most of them were dead. The remainder were taken prisoner. A last Russian attack was made that day, mounted with great vigour by General Cerelius, successor to General Artemonov of the 1st Corps, who had been dismissed. Collecting various scattered and still fresh regiments and artillery units, which had not been in battle, and aggregated about a division, he launched an offensive that broke through Francois' lines and succeeded in retaking Niedernburg. It came too late and could not be sustained. This last act of the Russian Second Army had not been ordered by General Samsonov, for he was dead. On the night of August 29, he too, like General Martos, was caught in the net in a different part of the forest. Riding through the woods that fringed the railroad, he and his companions reached Willenburg, only 7 miles from the Russian frontier, but the Germans had arrived there before them. The general and his group waited in the forest until nightfall, and then, as it was impossible to proceed over the swampy ground in the dark on horseback, continued on foot. Matches gave out, and they could no longer read their compass. Moving hand in hand to avoid losing each other in the dark, they stumbled on. Samsonov, who suffered from asthma, was visibly weakening. He kept repeating to Potovsky, his chief of staff, "The Tsar trusted me. How can I face him after such a disaster?" After covering 6 miles, they stopped for a rest. It was then 1 a.m. Samsonov moved apart into the thicker darkness under the pines. A shot cracked the stillness of the night. Potovsky knew instantly what it meant. Earlier, Samsonov had confided his intention of committing suicide, but Potovsky thought he had argued him out of it. He was now sure the general was dead. The staff officers tried to find the body in the darkness, but failed. They decided to wait until dawn, but as the sky began to lighten, German troops were heard approaching. Forsaking their task, the Russians were forced to move on toward the frontier, where they fell in with a Cossack patrol and eventually made their way to safety. Samsonov's body was found by the Germans, who buried it at Willenburg, where in 1916, with the help of the Red Cross, his widow was able to retrieve it and bring it back for burial in Russia. Silence had enveloped the Second Army. At Zhilinsky's headquarters, wireless contact was dead. Nothing had been heard from Samsonov for 2 days. Now that it was too late, Zhilinsky ordered Rennenkampf's cavalry to break through the German lines at Allenstein and find out what had happened to the Second Army. The mission was never to be accomplished, for already the German Eighth Army, having destroyed one arm of the pincers that was to have crushed them, was turning to deal with the other. Almost with awe, they realized the extent of their victory. The haul of enemy dead and prisoners and captured guns was enormous. 92,000 prisoners were taken, and according to some claims, the count was higher. 60 trains were required to bring them to the rear during the week after the battle. Captured guns were counted variously between 300 and 500 out of the Second Army's total of some 600. Captured horses were driven in herds to corrals hurriedly built to hold them. Although no agreed casualty figure for the dead and missing exists, it was estimated at over 30,000. The 15th and 13th Corps, by capture or death, were wiped out of existence. 50 officers and 2,100 men of these two corps were all that escaped. Survivors of the two flank corps, the 6th and 1st, which retreated earliest, amounted to about a division each, and of the 23rd Corps to about a brigade. The victors, too, suffered heavily. After the fatigue and suspense of a 6-day battle, their nerves were raw. When Niedernberg, which changed hands 4 times, was retaken by the Germans on August 31, a nervous military policeman shouted, "Halt!" at a car driving at high speed across the main square. When the car, which contained General von Morgan, ignored his order, he yelled, "Stop, Russians!" and fired. Instantly a volley of fire covered the car, killing the chauffeur and wounding an officer sitting beside the general. The same night, after barely escaping being shot by his own men, von Morgan was awakened by his valet, who, crying, "The Russians have come back," ran off clutching the general's clothes. To his extreme vexation, von Morgan was forced to emerge in the street, strapping his revolver over his underclothes. For all but a few officers, it had been their first experience under fire. And out of the excited fancy produced by the fears and exhaustion and panic and violence of a great battle, a legend grew, a legend of thousands of Russians drowning in the swamps or sinking up to their necks in bogs and quicksands, men whom the Germans were forced to slaughter with machine guns. "I will hear their cries to my dying day," one officer told an awestruck audience of friends in Germany. "The widely circulated report of Russians driven into the marshes and perishing there is a myth," Ludendorff wrote. "No marsh was to be found anywhere near." As the extent of the enemy's defeat became clear, the German commanders began to consider that they had won, as Hoffmann wrote in his diary, one of the great victories in history. It was decided, according to Hoffmann at his suggestion, according to Ludendorff at my suggestion, to name the battle Tannenberg, in delayed compensation for the ancient defeat suffered there by the Teutonic Knights at the hands of the Poles and Lithuanians. In spite of this second triumph, even greater than Liège, Ludendorff could not rejoice, because the strain imposed on my nerves by the uncertainty about Rennenkampf's army had been too great. He was now able, however, to turn with greater confidence against Rennenkampf, with the addition of the two new corps that Moltke was sending from the west. His triumph owed much to others. To Hoffmann, who, though right for the wrong reasons, had been firm in the conviction that Rennenkampf would not pursue, and had conceived the plan and drawn up the orders for bringing the Eighth Army down to face Samsonov. To François, who, by defying Ludendorff's orders, ensured the envelopment of Samsonov's left wing. To Hindenburg, who steadied Ludendorff's nerves at a critical moment. Finally, and above all, to a factor that never figured in the careful German planning, the Russian wireless. Ludendorff came to depend on the intercepts, which his staff regularly collected during the day, decoded or translated, and sent to him every night at 11 p.m. If by chance they were late, he would worry and appear personally in the signal corps room to inquire what was the matter. Hoffman acknowledged the intercepts as the real victor of Tannenberg. We had an ally, he said, the enemy. We knew all the enemy's plans. To the public, the saviour of East Prussia was the nominal commander, Hindenburg. The elderly general, dragged from retirement in his old blue uniform, was transformed into a titan by the victory. The triumph in East Prussia, lauded and heralded even beyond its true proportions, fastened the Hindenburg myth upon Germany. Not even Hoffmann's sly malice could penetrate it. When, as chief of staff on the Eastern Front later in the war, he would take visitors over the field of Tannenberg, Hoffmann would tell them, "This is where the field marshal slept before the battle. Here is where he slept after the battle. Here is where he slept during the battle." In Russia, the disaster did not penetrate the public mind at once, being blotted out by a great victory won at the same time over the Austrians on the Galician front. In numbers, an even greater victory than the Germans won at Tannenberg, it had equal effect on the enemy. In a series of engagements fought from August 26 to September 10 and culminating in the Battle of Lemberg, the Russians inflicted 250,000 casualties, took 100,000 prisoners, forced the Austrians into a retreat lasting 18 days and covering 150 miles, and accomplished a mutilation of the Austro-Hungarian army, especially in trained officers, from which it was never to recover. It crippled Austria, but could not restore the losses or heal the effects of Tannenberg. The Russian Second Army had ceased to exist. General Samsonov was dead, and of his five corps commanders, two were captured, and three cashiered for incompetence. General Rennenkampf, in the ensuing Battle of the Masurian Lakes, was chased out of East Prussia, lost his nerve — in this case the customary formula was applied by Jelinski — deserted his army and drove back across the frontier in a motor car, thus completing the ruin of his reputation and bringing about his discharge in disgrace, and incidentally that of Jelinski. In a telegram to the Grand Duke, Jelinski accused Rennenkampf of having decamped in panic. This infuriated the Grand Duke, who considered the primary failure to have been Jelinski's. He thereupon reported to the Tsar that it was Jelinski who has lost his head and is incapable of controlling operations, with the result that another actor in the Battle of Tannenberg became a casualty. The inadequacy of training and materials, the incompetence of generals, the inefficiency of organization were laid bare by the battle. Alexander Guchkov, a subsequent Minister of War, testified that he reached the firm conviction that the war was lost after Tannenberg. The defeat gave new vigour to the pro-German groups, who began openly to agitate for withdrawal from the war. Count Wittier was convinced the war would ruin Russia, Rasputin that it would destroy the regime. The ministers of Justice and of Interior drew up a memorandum for the Tsar urging peace with Germany as soon as possible, on the ground that continued alliance with democracies would be fatal. The opportunity was offered. German proposals to Russia for a separate peace began shortly afterward and continued through 1915 and 1916. Whether out of loyalty to the Allies and the Pact of London, or fear of making terms with the Germans, or insensibility to the lapping tide of revolution, or simply paralysis of authority, the Russians never accepted them. In mounting chaos and dwindling ammunition, their war effort went on. At the time of the disaster, General Marquis de la Guiche, the French military attaché, came to express his condolences to the commander-in-chief. "We are happy to have made such sacrifices for our allies," the Grand Duke replied gallantly. Equanimity in the face of catastrophe was his code, and Russians, in the knowledge of inexhaustible supplies of manpower, are accustomed to accepting gigantic fatalities with comparative calm. The Russian steamroller, in which the Western Allies placed such hopes, which after their debacle on the Western Front was awaited even more anxiously, had fallen apart on the road as if it had been put together with pins. In its premature start and early demise, it had been, just as the Grand Duke said, a sacrifice for an ally. Whatever it cost the Russians, the sacrifice accomplished what the French wanted: withdrawal of German strength from the Western Front. The two corps that came too late for Tannenberg were to be absent from the Marne. Chapter 17. The Flames of Louvain. In 1915, a book about the invasion of his country was published in exile by Emile Verheeren, Belgium's leading living poet, whose life before 1914 had been a flaming dedication to socialist and humanitarian ideals that were then believed to erase national lines. He prefaced his account with this dedication. "He who writes this book, in which hate is not hidden, was formerly a pacifist. For him, no disillusionment was ever greater or more sudden. It struck him with such violence that he thought himself no longer the same man. And yet, as it seems to him that in this state of hatred his conscience becomes diminished, he dedicates these pages with emotion to the man he used to be." Of all that has been written, Verheeren's is the most poignant testimony of what war and invasion did to the mind of his time. When the Battle of the Frontiers ended, the war had been in progress for 20 days, and during that time it created passions, attitudes, ideas and issues both among belligerents and watching neutrals, which determined its future course and the course of history since. The world that used to be and the ideas that shaped it disappeared too, like the wraith of Verheeren's former self, down the corridors of August and the months that followed. Those deterrents, the brotherhood of socialists, the interlocking of finance, commerce and other economic factors, which had been expected to make war impossible, failed to function when the time came. Nationhood, like a wild gust of wind, arose and swept them aside. People entered the war with varying sentiments and sets of ideas. Among the belligerents, some, pacifists and socialists, opposed the war in their hearts. Some, like Rupert Brooke, welcomed it. "Now God be thanked who has matched us with his hour," wrote Brooke, conscious of no blasphemy, in his poem 1914. To him it seemed a time to turn as swimmers into cleanness, leaping, glad from a world grown old and cold and weary. Honour has come back, and nobleness walks in our ways again, and we have come into our heritage. Germans felt similar emotions. The war was to be, wrote Thomas Mann, a purification, a liberation, an enormous hope. The victory of Germany will be a victory of soul over numbers. "The German soul," he explained, "is opposed to the pacifist ideal of civilization, for is not peace an element of civil corruption?" This concept, a mirror image of the essential German militarist theory that war is ennobling, was not very far from the raptures of Rupert Brooke, and was widely held at the time by numbers of respectable people, among them Theodore Roosevelt. In 1914, except for Balkan wars on the fringe, there had been no war on the European continent for more than a generation, and in the opinion of one observer, the welcoming attitude toward war owed something to the unconscious boredom of peace. Where Brooke was embracing cleanness and nobleness, Mann saw a more positive goal. Germans, being, he said, the most educated, law-abiding, peace-loving of all peoples, deserved to be the most powerful, to dominate, to establish a German peace out of what is being called, with every possible justification, the German War. Though writing in 1917, Mann was reflecting 1914, the year that was to be the German 1789, the establishment of the German idea in history, the enthronement of Kultur, the fulfillment of Germany's historic mission. In August, sitting at a café in Aachen, a German scientist said to the American journalist Erwin Cobb, "We Germans are the most industrious, the most earnest, the best educated race in Europe. Russia stands for reaction, England for selfishness and perfidy, France for decadence, Germany for progress. German culture will enlighten the world, and after this war, there will never be another." A German businessman sitting with them had more specific aims. Russia was to be so humbled that never again could the Slav peril threaten Europe. Great Britain was to be utterly crushed and deprived of her navy, India and Egypt. France was to pay an indemnity from which she would never recover. Belgium was to yield her seacoast because Germany needed ports on the English Channel. Japan was to be punished in due time. An alliance of all the Teutonic and Scandinavian races in Europe, including Bulgaria, will hold absolute dominion from the North Sea to the Black Sea. Europe will have a new map, and Germany will be at the center of it. Talk of this kind for years before the war had not increased friendliness for Germany. "We often got on the world's nerves," admitted Bethmann Hollweg, "by frequently proclaiming Germany's right to lead the world." This, he explained, was interpreted as lust for world dominion, but was really a boyish and unbalanced ebullience. The world somehow failed to see it that way. There was a stridency in the German tone that conveyed more menace than ebullience. "The world became sore-headed and fed up," wrote Mr. George Bernard Shaw in 1914, "with Germany's clattering of the sword. We were rasped beyond endurance by Prussian militarism and its contempt for us and for human happiness and common sense, and we just rose at it and went for it." Some rose at it with a clear sense of the issues, satisfying at least to them, some with only the vaguest notion of the whys and wherefores, some with none at all. Mr. H. G. Wells was one of the first kind. "The enemy," he announced in the press of August 4, "was German imperialism and militarism, the monstrous vanity begotten in 1870. The victory of Germany, of blood and iron, flag-wagging Teutonic Kiplingism, would mean the permanent enthronement of the war god over all human affairs. The defeat of Germany may," Mr. Wells did not say will, "open the way to disarmament and peace throughout the world." Less clear as to issues was a British reservist, who in the train on his way to the depot explained to a fellow passenger, "I'm a-going to fight the bloody Belgians, that's where I'm a-going." A third kind, happy to fight without any war aims at all, was Major Sir Tom Bridges, commander of the cavalry squadron which killed the first Germans on the road to Soigny. "There was no hatred of Germany," he said. "We were quite ready to fight anybody, and would equally readily have fought the French. Our motto was, we'll do it, what is it?" Having an old score to settle, the French had no need to explain themselves. The German at their gates was enough. Yet here too was felt the enormous hope. Bergson believed that although the ultimate success of the Allies would require terrible sacrifices, out of them would come, along with the rejuvenation and enlargement of France, the moral regeneration of Europe. Then, with the advent of a real peace, France and humanity can resume the march forward, only forward, toward truth and justice. These were not the public attitudes of statesmen or the group attitudes of masses, but the private attitudes of individuals. None were yet as fixed as they were to become. National hatred of Germany had not yet taken hold. Among the first and most memorable of Punch's cartoons on the war was one that appeared on August 12, labelled No Thoroughfare. Brave little Belgium is there, a stern small boy in wooden shoes, barring the way to the trespasser. Germany, pictured as a fat old bandmaster with a string of sausages hanging out of his pocket. He is ludicrous, not evil. Otherwise, in the early days, the cartoonist's pet was the Crown Prince, whom they delighted to draw as an exaggerated fop, with pinched waist, high tight collar, rakish cap, and an expression of fatuous vacuity. He did not last. The war becoming too serious, he was replaced by the best-known German, the Supreme Warlord, whose name was signed to every order of OHL, so that he seemed the author of all German acts, the Kaiser. No longer the pre-war mischief-maker and sabre-rattler, he was now depicted as a dark, satanic tyrant, breathing cruelty and malignancy, expressing brutality in every line. The change began in August, and progressed from Bridges' cool statement, "There was no hatred of Germany," to that of Stephen McKenna, who wrote in 1921, "Among those who remember, the name of a German stinks, and the presence of a German is an outrage." No pseudo-heroic super-patriot, but a sober, thoughtful schoolteacher whose memoirs are a social document of the time, McKenna recorded a change of sentiment that was to prevent any negotiated settlement and keep the fighting going until total victory. What wrought the change was what happened to Belgium. The turn of events in Belgium was a product of the German theory of terror. Clausewitz had prescribed terror as the proper method to shorten war, his whole theory of war being based on the necessity of making it short, sharp, and decisive. The civil population must not be exempted from war's effects, but must be made to feel its pressure and be forced by the severest measures to compel their leaders to make peace. as the object of war was to disarm the enemy, we must place him in a situation in which continuing the war is more oppressive to him than surrender. This seemingly sound proposition fitted into the scientific theory of war, which throughout the 19th century it had been the best intellectual endeavour of the German General Staff to construct. It had already been put into practice in 1870, when French resistance sprang up after Sedan. The ferocity of German reprisal at that time, in the form of executions of prisoners and civilians on charges of franc-tireur warfare, startled a world agape with admiration at Prussia's marvellous 6-week victory. Suddenly it became aware of the beast beneath the German skin. Although 1870 proved the corollary of the theory and practice of terror, that it deepens antagonism, stimulates resistance, and ends by lengthening war, the Germans remained wedded to it. As Shaw said, they were a people with a contempt for common sense. On August 23, placards signed by General von Bülow were posted in Liège, announcing that the people of Andenne, a small town on the Meuse near Namur, having attacked his troops in the most traitorous manner, with my permission, the general commanding these troops has burned the town to ashes and has had 110 persons shot. The people of Liège were being informed, so that they would know what fate to expect if they behaved in the same manner as their neighbours. The burning of Andenne, and the massacre, which Belgian figures put at 211, took place on August 20 and 21 during the Battle of Charleroi. Hewing to their timetable, harassed by the Belgians' blowing up of bridges and railroads, Bülow's commanders dealt out reprisals ruthlessly in the villages they entered. At Sailly, across the river from Andenne, 50 civilians were shot, and the houses given over to looting and burning. At Tamines, captured on August 21, sack of the town began that evening after the battle and continued all night and next day. The usual orgy of permitted looting, accompanied by drinking, released inhibitions and brought the soldiers to the desired state of raw excitement, which was intended to add to the fearful effect. On the second day, at Tamines, some 400 citizens were herded together under guard in front of the church in the main square, and a firing squad began systematically shooting into the group. Those not dead when the firing ended were bayoneted. In the cemetery at Tamines, there are 384 gravestones inscribed, 1914, fusillé par les Allemands. When Bülow's army took Namur, a city of 32,000, notices were posting announcing that 10 hostages were being taken from every street who would be shot if any civilian fired on a German. The taking and killing of hostages was practiced as systematically as the requisitioning of food. The farther the Germans advanced, the more hostages were arrested. At first, when von Kluck's army entered a town, notices immediately went up, warning the populace that the burgomaster, the leading magistrate and the senator of the district were being held as hostages, with the usual warning as to their fate. Soon, 3 persons of prestige were not enough. A man from every street, even 10 from every street, were not enough. Walter Blum, a novelist mobilized as a reserve officer in von Kluck's army, whose account of the advance to Paris is invaluable, tells how in villages where his company was billeted each night, Major von Kleist gave orders that a man, or if no man was available, a woman, be taken from every household as a hostage. Through some peculiar failure of the system, the greater the terror, the more terror seemed to be necessary. When sniping was reported in a town, the hostages were executed. Erwin Cobb, accompanying von Kluck's army, watched from a window as 2 civilians were marched between 2 rows of German soldiers with fixed bayonets. They were taken behind the railroad station, there was a sound of shots, and 2 litters were carried out, bearing still figures covered by blankets, with only the rigid toes of their boots showing. Cobb watched while twice more the performance was repeated. Vizay, scene of the first fighting on the way to Liège on the first day of the invasion, was destroyed not by troops fresh from the heat of battle, but by occupation troops long after the battle had moved on. In response to a report of sniping, a German regiment was sent to Vizay from Liège on August 23. That night the sound of shooting could be heard at Eisden, just over the border in Holland, 5 miles away. Next day, Eisden was overwhelmed by a flood of 4,000 refugees. The entire population of Visay, except for those who had been shot, and for 700 men and boys who had been deported for harvest labour to Germany. The deportations, which were to have such moral effect, especially upon the United States, began in August. Afterward, when Brand Whitlock, the American minister, visited what had been Visay, he saw only empty, blackened houses open to the sky, a vista of ruins that might have been Pompeii. Every inhabitant was gone. There was not a living thing, not a roof. At Dinan, on the Meuse, on August 23, the Saxons of General von Hausen's army were fighting the French in a final engagement of the Battle of Charleroi. Von Hausen personally witnessed the perfidious activity of Belgian civilians in hampering reconstruction of bridges, so contrary to international law. His troops began rounding up several hundreds of hostages, men, women and children. 50 were taken from church, the day being Sunday. The general saw them tightly crowded, standing, sitting, lying, in a group under guard of the grenadiers, their faces displaying fear, nameless anguish, concentrated rage, and desire for revenge, provoked by all the calamities they'd suffered. Von Hausen, who was very sensitive, felt an indomitable hostility emanating from them. He was the general who had been made so unhappy in the house of the Belgian gentleman who clenched his fists in his pockets and refused to speak to von Hausen at dinner. In the group at Dinan, he saw a wounded French soldier with blood streaming from his head, who lay dying, mute and apathetic, refusing all medical help. Von Hausen ends his description there, too sensitive to tell the fate of Dinan's citizens. They were kept in the main square till evening, then lined up, women on one side, men opposite in two rows, one kneeling in front of the other. Two firing squads marched to the centre of the square, faced either way, and fired till no more of the targets stood upright. 612 bodies were identified and buried, including Felix Vivet, aged 3 weeks. The Saxons were then let loose in a riot of pillage and arson. The medieval citadel, perched like an eagle's nest on the heights of the right bank above the city it had once protected, looked down upon a repetition of the ravages of the Middle Ages. The Saxons left Dinan scorched, crumbled, hollowed out, charred and sodden. Profoundly moved by the picture of desolation wrought by his troops, General von Hausen departed from the ruins of Dinan, secure in the conviction that the responsibility lay with the Belgian government, which approved this perfidious street fighting contrary to international law. The Germans were obsessively concerned about violations of international law. They succeeded in overlooking the violation created by their presence in Belgium, in favour of the violation committed, as they saw it, by Belgians resisting their presence. With a sigh of long-tried patience, Abbé Vertelet, Alsatian delegate to the Reichstag, once confessed, "To a mind formed in the Latin school, the German mentality is difficult to comprehend." The German obsession had two parts, that Belgian resistance was illegal, and that it was organized from above by the Belgian government, or by burgomasters, priests, and other persons who could be classified as above. Together, the two parts established the corollary, that German reprisals were righteous and legal regardless of degree. The shooting of a single hostage or the massacre of 612 and the razing of a town were alike to be charged to the Belgian government. This was the refrain of every German from Hausen after Dinan to the Kaiser after Louvain. The responsibility must fall upon those who incited the population to attack the Germans, Hausen protests constantly. There can be absolutely no doubt, he insists, that the whole population of Dinan and other regions was animated, by whose order, by one desire to stop the advance of the Germans. That people could be animated to stop the invader without an order from above was inconceivable. The Germans saw these orders everywhere. Von Kluck claimed that the Belgian government's posters warning its citizens against hostile acts were actually incitements to the civil population to fire on the enemy. Ludendorff accused the Belgian government of having systematically organized civilian warfare. The Crown Prince applied the same theory to French civil resistance. He complained that the fanatical people of the Longwy region shot at us treacherously and perfidiously from doors and windows with sporting guns which had been sent from Paris for the purpose. Had the royal travels included closer acquaintance with the French countryside, where a sporting gun for shooting hare on Sundays was as normal equipment as a pair of pants, he might have known it did not require guns sent from Paris to arm the franc-tireurs. German accounts of their experiences in enemy territory become shrill with hysteria on the subject of guerrilla warfare. Ludendorff called it disgusting. He, whose name was soon to become a byword for trickery, violence, and cunning, had taken the field, he says, with chivalrous and humane conceptions of warfare, but franc-tireur methods caused me personally bitter disillusionment. Captain Blum was haunted by the monstrous thought that he might be hit or killed by a bullet fired by a civilian, although until a fortnight ago he had been a civilian himself. During an exhausting march of 28 miles in one day, he reports not one soldier fell out of line, because the thought of falling into the hands of the Walloons was worse than sore feet, that other great agony of the march on Paris. Fear and horror of the franc-tireurs sprang from the German feeling that civil resistance was essentially disorderly. If there has to be a choice between injustice and disorder, said Goethe, the German prefers injustice. Schooled in a state in which the relation of the subject to the sovereign has no basis other than obedience, he is unable to understand a state organized upon any other foundation, and when he enters one, is inspired by an intense uneasiness. Comfortable only in the presence of authority, he regards the civilian sniper as something particularly sinister. To the Western mind, the franc-tireur is a hero. To the German, he is a heretic who threatens the existence of the state. At Soissons, there is a bronze and marble monument to 3 schoolteachers who raised a revolt of students and civilians against the Prussians in 1870. Gazing at it in amazement, a German officer said to an American reporter in 1914, "That's the French for you, putting up a monument to glorify franc-tireurs. In Germany, the people would not be allowed to do such a thing, nor is it conceivable that they would want to." To put the German soldier in the proper frame of mind, German newspapers were filled from the first week, as Captain Blum recorded, with stories of the Belgians' revolting cruelties of armed priests at the head of marauding bands of civilians committing every kind of atrocity, of treacherous ambushes on patrols, of sentries found with eyes pierced and tongues cut off. Similar ghastly rumours had already reached Berlin by August 11, to be recorded by Princess Blücher. A German officer, whom she asked for verification, told her that in Aachen at that moment there were 30 German officers lying in the hospital with their eyes put out by Belgian women and children. Emotions aroused by such stories made it easy, by a single cry of "snipers," to set the German soldier off on a rampage of pillaging, arson and murder, uninhibited by the officers. Schrecklichkeit, terror, was intended as a substitute for the occupation troops, which the High Command could not afford to divert from the march on Paris. On August 25, the burning of Louvain began. The medieval city on the road from Liège to Brussels was renowned for its university and incomparable library, founded in 1426, when Berlin was a clump of wooden huts. Housed in the 14th-century clothworkers' hall, the library included among its 230,000 volumes a unique collection of 750 medieval manuscripts and over 1,000 incunabula. The façade of the town hall, called a jewel of Gothic art, was a stone tapestry of carved knights and saints and ladies, lavish even of its kind. In the church of Saint-Pierre were altar panels by Dirk Bouts and other Flemish masters. The burning and sack of Louvain, accompanied by the invariable shooting of civilians, lasted 6 days before it was called off as abruptly as it began. Everything went smoothly when Louvain was first occupied. The shops did a rush of business. German soldiers behaved in exemplary fashion, bought postcards and souvenirs, paid for all their purchases, and stood in line with the regular customers for haircuts at the barber shop. The second day was more strained. A German soldier was shot in the leg, allegedly by snipers. The Burgomaster urgently repeated his call upon civilians to surrender arms. He and two other officials were arrested as hostages. Executions behind the railroad station became frequent. The endless tramp of von Kluck's columns continued through the city, day after day. On August 25, the Belgian army at Malines, on the edge of the entrenched camp of Antwerp, made a sudden sharp sortie upon the rearguard of von Kluck's army, flinging them back in disorder upon Louvain. In the turmoil of retreat, a riderless horse, clattering through the gates after dark, frightened another horse, which tried to bolt, fell in harness, and overturned the wagon. Shots rang out, setting off cries of, "Die Franzosen sind da! Die Engländer sind da! The French are coming! The English are coming!" Later, the Germans claimed they'd been fired on by Belgian civilians, or that civilians had fired from rooftops as signals to the Belgian army. Belgians claimed that German soldiers had fired on one another in the dark. For weeks and months, even years, after the event that appalled the world, judicial inquiries and tribunals investigated the outbreak, and German accusations were contradicted by Belgian countercharges. Who shot whom was never established, and was in any case irrelevant to what followed, for the Germans burned Louvain not as a punishment for alleged Belgian misdeeds, but as a deterrent and a warning to all their enemies, a gesture of German might before all the world. General von Luttwitz, the new governor of Brussels, expressed as much next morning. Visited in the course of duty by the American and Spanish ministers, he said to them, "A dreadful thing has occurred at Louvain. Our general there has been shot by the son of the burgomaster. The population has fired on our troops." He paused, looked at his visitors, and finished, "And now, of course, we have to destroy the city." Mr. Whitlock was to hear so often the story of one or another German general being shot by the son or sometimes the daughter of a burgomaster, that it seemed to him the Belgians must have bred a special race of burgomaster's children, like the assassins of Syria. Already word of the flames at Louvain had spread. Stunned and weeping refugees, driven from the city, told of street after street set on fire, of savage looting and continuing arrests and executions. On August 27, Richard Harding Davis, star of the American correspondents who were then in Belgium, made his way to Louvain by troop train. He was kept locked in the railroad car by the Germans, but the fire had by then reached the boulevard Tirlemont facing the railroad station, and he could see the steady, straight columns of flames rising from the rows of houses. The German soldiers were drunk and wild. One thrust his head through the window of the car where another correspondent, Arno Dosch, was confined, and cried, "Three cities razed! Three! There will be more!" On August 28, Hugh Gibson, first secretary of the American legation, accompanied by his Swedish and Mexican colleagues, went to Louvain to see for themselves. Houses with blackened walls and smouldering timbers were still burning. Pavements were hot, cinders were everywhere. Dead horses and dead people lay about. One old man, a civilian with a white beard, lay on his back in the sun. Many of the bodies were swollen, evidently dead for several days. Wreckage, furniture, bottles, torn clothing, one wooden shoe was strewn among the ashes. German soldiers of the 9th Reserve Corps, some drunk, some nervous, unhappy and bloodshot, were routing inhabitants out of the remaining houses so that, as the soldiers told Gibson, the destruction of the city could be completed. They went from house to house, battering down doors, stuffing pockets with cigars, looting valuables, then plying the torch. As the houses were chiefly of brick and stone, the fire did not spread of itself. An officer in charge in one street watched gloomily, smoking a cigar. He was rabid against the Belgians, and kept repeating to Gibson, "We shall wipe it out! Not one stone will stand upon another! Kein Stein auf einander! Not one, I tell you! We will teach them to respect Germany. For generations people will come here to see what we have done." It was the German way of making themselves memorable. In Brussels, the rector of the university, Monseigneur de Becker, whose rescue was arranged by the Americans, described the burning of the library. Nothing was left of it. All was in ashes. When he came to the word library, bibliothèque, he could not say it. He stopped, tried again, uttered the first syllable, la bib. and then, unable to go on, bowed his head on the table and wept. The loss, made the subject of a public protest by the Belgian government and officially reported by the American legation, caused an outcry in the outside world while the fire was still raging. Eyewitness accounts by refugees, reported by all the correspondents, filled the foreign press. Besides the university and library, all the noble public buildings, including the town hall and Saint-Pierre with all its pictures, were said to have been destroyed. Only later was it found that, though damaged, the town hall and the church were still standing. "Germans sack Louvain, women and clergy shot," blazed the headline in the New York Tribune above Davis's story. Under a subhead, "Berlin confirms Louvain horror," it carried a wireless statement from Berlin issued by the German embassy in Washington that following perfidious attack by Belgian citizens, Louvain was punished by the destruction of the city. Identical with General von Luttwitz's statement, it showed that Berlin had no wish for the world to misunderstand the nature of the gesture at Louvain. Destruction of cities and deliberate acknowledged war on non-combatants were concepts shocking to the world of 1914. In England, editorials proclaimed the March of the Hun and treason to civilization. The burning of the library, said the Daily Chronicle, meant war not only on non-combatants, but on posterity to the utmost generation. Even the usually quiet and carefully neutral Dutch papers were stung to comment. "Whatever the cause of the outbreak," said the Rotterdam Courant, "the fact of destruction remains, a fact so terrible that the whole world must have received the news with horror." The reports appeared in the foreign press of August 29. On August 30, the process of destroying Louvain was terminated. On the same day, an official communique of the German Foreign Office affirmed that the entire responsibility for these events rests with the Belgian government, not forgetting the usual claim that women and girls took part in the fight and blinded our wounded, gouging their eyes out. "Why did the Germans do it?" people asked all over the world. "Are you descendants of Goethe or of Attila the Hun?" protested Romain Rolland in a public letter to his former friend Gerhard Hauptmann, Germany's literary lion. King Albert, in conversation with the French minister, thought the mainspring was the German sense of inferiority and jealousy. "These people are envious, unbalanced and ill-tempered. They burned the library of Louvain simply because it was unique and universally admired." In other words, a barbarian's gesture of anger against civilized things. Valid in part, this explanation overlooked the deliberate use of terror as prescribed by the Kriegsbrauch. War cannot be conducted merely against the combatants of an enemy state, but must seek to destroy the total material and intellectual, geistig, resources of the enemy. To the world, it remained the gesture of a barbarian. The gesture that was intended by the Germans to frighten the world, to induce submission, instead convinced large numbers of people that here was an enemy with whom there could be no settlement and no compromise. Belgium clarified issues, became to many the supreme issue of the war. "In America," said a historian of his times, looking back, "Belgium was the precipitant of opinion, and Louvain was the climax of Belgium." Matthias Erzberger, soon to be appointed chief of propaganda when that unhappy necessity forced itself upon Germany, found that Belgium aroused almost the entire world against Germany. The argument of his counter-propaganda, that Germany's conduct was justified by military necessity and self-defense, was, as he admitted with a certain wry regret, insufficient. It did the Kaiser little good to take the offensive 10 days after Louvain in a telegram to President Wilson saying, "My heart bleeds for the sufferings of Belgium, caused as a result of the criminal and barbarous action of the Belgians." Their resistance, he explained, had been openly incited and carefully organized by the Belgian government, compelling his generals to take the strongest measures against the bloodthirsty population. It did little good for 93 German professors and other intellectuals to issue a manifesto addressed to the civilized world, proclaiming the civilizing effects of German culture and stating, "It is not true that we have criminally violated the neutrality of Belgium. It is not true that our troops have brutally destroyed Louvain." However imposing the signatories, Harnack, Sudermann, Humperdinck, Röntgen, Hauptmann, the mute ashes of the library spoke louder. By the end of August, people of the Allied nations were persuaded that they faced an enemy that had to be beaten.